had a dream about a person in a kitchen, and I turned and it was love, and life was wonderful again. We looked into each other's eyes, a moment so incredible. I woke up feeling empty, like you do when good dreams end. You want to keep it comfortable to sleep together sometimes, for me to rub your shoulder and maybe kiss your ear. What you don't understand, because I think you've never felt it, is my need to hold you and be held, to have the fear of waking up alone dispelled by trust that you will be here. The other day, while dozing on the couch, I had a dream about a person in a kitchen, and I turned and it was love, and life was wonderful again. What you don't seem to realize is you could be that person, but you're not, 'cause you don't want to be. You want to be my friend. We looked into each other's eyes, a moment so incredible. I woke up feeling empty, like you do when good dreams end.
I'm J.D. Doyle, and welcome to Queer Music Heritage and part three of my April show and my John Bacchino special. I opened this part with a song by Michael Ferrari. In 2000, he released his only album called Sweet Dreams, making John's song the title track. But he also included on his album a more obscure song John wrote called A Dream.
The composer Adam Gettle sung Unexpressed on the Grateful compilation, but he's also Richard Rodgers' grandson, who owns the piano used on another album of yours.
He is, and he does own his grandfather's piano. And again, if you live long enough, you just get to see little lines of connectedness and little circles of completion and things. And the first show music that I ever heard was Carousel. My mom had a little box of 45 records of the musical Carousel by Rodgers and Hammerstein. So Richard Rodgers' music was among the first music that I ever heard. Well, of course, flash forward 40 years or so, and I suddenly am represented by the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization. And living in New York, I've gotten to know Rodgers' daughter, Mary Rodgers, and her son, Adam Gettle, who, as I said, is one of my favorite composers, songwriters, and that there is. But also has his grandfather's piano, and also, at the time anyway, had a recording studio when he used to have a wonderful apartment here in New York with his grandfather's piano and a recording studio. So over the years, people had, I started playing piano when I was one, just playing by ear. My grandmother had a piano and I would noodle around on it, and it became my favorite toy, and it still is. And didn't take piano lessons, and just sort of evolved organically. And people over the years have said that I should do a solo piano recording, but I just sort of took, my piano playing for granted and thought, well, it's just what I do, but there's no reason to document it. Until I had this idea to do a recording of Richard Rodgers' music, improvisations on Richard Rodgers' songs, on the piano that he actually wrote them on. And so that's what I did. Just kind of winged it, and over several recording sessions, went in and played every Rogers song I could think of, and whatever wacky way popped into my fingers. I didn't really plan them. And then I just took the complete best versions of each song and didn't edit anything, didn't fix anything, made it into this CD, which I did, produced myself and released myself through my website. We should mention that website, don't you think? Would that be all right?
We will.
We will. Good. But anyway, it's called On Richard Rogers Piano, and I am perhaps more proud of that than anything I've ever done.
From that album, it was hard to pick, but here's John's interpretation of Where or When.
I think the song, The Line Forms on the Right, is a fun song.
Ha!
Tell me about that one.
Stephen Schwartz and I had never written anything together, and he was doing one of, his CDs, I don't remember if it was the first one or the second one, of songs that he wrote, just out of his own personal experience, which I had suggested that he do. And so it seemed appropriate that we should do something together. And he had this lyric, and he asked if I wanted to try writing music to it, and so I did. Simple as that. It was really fun.
By the way, I did meet Stephen very briefly.
Really?
I was at the An Out Music Showcase in, I think, 2006, and he was performing with Brian Lane Green was performing, Leela Sack was performing, and I kind of nudged Lee, introduce me.
Yeah, he's a wonderful fellow. Well, both Lee and Stephen, actually. I know them all. But Stephen's just the best.
From the Stephen Swartz album from 2001 called Uncharted Territory, here's the song The Line Forms on the Right.
There's the one who you're just leaving. There's the one who you just left. There's the one you're only sleeping with, and the one you aren't over yet. Your men stack up like airplanes on the runway, politely waiting clearance for the flight. Would I be so asinine as to join that desperate line? When baby, the line forms on the right. There's the one who you hold captive. There's the one who you set free. There's the one you give your number to at the party you attend with me. And you'll bitch to me next day because he called you. And I'll express my pity for your plight. So you'll see that I'm just fine with each new face that joins the line. Face it, the line forms on the right.
Line forms on the right.
It's not that you're so beautiful or sexy. I don't know how you make so many fall. I wonder, could it be your air of unavailability? When really, you're available, available to all. Tell me who you're over, and you point out who you think you want. And I laugh and never tell you what I'm feeling. And I wonder if I'm daft or deaf, trying to sneak up on you from the left. Yes, it proves I'm none too bright, keeping up this losing fight. When baby, the long, 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 long line forms on the right.
Line forms on the right.
It's a long, long line.
Line forms on the right. The line forms on the right.
You don't often collaborate with other writers. Is this
no.
by design?
Kind of. You know, it feels like cheating somehow. I know that seems silly, but it's like since I can do both, I kind of like doing both. And also there's a wonderful alchemy, for me anyway, that happens between a lyric and music. That is different when it's my lyric and my music. I'm just more in the process. It's painful, but really rewarding, you know. But I have, interestingly, recently, and maybe you're going to get to this, been thrown into a collaboration that I never expected recently on a children's musical. called Simeon's Gift that's based on a book by Julie Andrews and her daughter, Emma Walton. And, you know, I got to meet them when they put out the Grateful children's book based on my song. And then Julie called and asked if I would consider writing just the lyrics to a children's musical with them. And my initial reaction was, wait a minute, you know, I do both. No, I don't want to write just the lyrics. But first of all, because it's Julie and she's an angel and the dearest, most wonderful person you could ever, as extraordinary and wonderful as you think she might be, she's even more so. You know, you can't imagine. She's an angel. She really is. So I would do anything for her, anything to work with her, anything to spend time with her. But also, A Catered Affair was really getting intense, and the preparations for Broadway were coming on. And I thought, well, wait a minute, this will actually be easier to just write lyrics and not have to deal with all the music preparation for this children's musical, because I'm going to be busy with A Catered Affair. And I ended up writing lyrics to, and the music was by Julie's longtime musical director and conductor, a British fellow named Ian Fraser, who is in his 70s now. And I didn't know him, but it turns out he is so brilliant, and it was such a gift to get to work with him, and such a delightful, painless, really fun process. I didn't meet him until we'd written the whole score, because he lives in Los Angeles. So we did it all long distance. And sometimes he would send me music and I would fit in lyrics to it. Sometimes I would send him lyrics and he would write music to it. It was a really kind of free-form, beautiful process. And, you know, Julie and Emma and I would have long phone conversations about what people should be singing about and things like that. And actually that has, it's called Simeon's Gift. And it was part of a concert evening that Julie hosted, where the first half of the concert with symphony orchestra, the first half was an all Rodgers and Hammerstein program with five great Broadway singers doing different songs. And Julie actually even sang a little bit. She sounded great. And then the second half of the program was a concert presentation of Simeon's Gift, orchestrated, you know, for full orchestra as well. And they did it at the Hollywood Bowl and for two performances. And I'm hoping that they do it more, because it's really beautiful.
Has it been recorded?
It has not been recorded, no. But there's talk about a tour of Australia and Japan with it, with, you know, various symphony orchestras there. So anything that gives me an excuse to travel, I'm all for.
Well, I didn't know about that project, but I was going to ask
it's
about
a good one.
Working with Lindy Robbins.
Oh, and Lindy is the person with whom I've collaborated the most, and one of the only people. I mean, I wrote one song with Steven. I've written a couple with Amanda McBroom, and then I wrote, you know, Simeon's Gift score with Ian. And Lindy, I've written 12 songs with, where she's all of which she's written lyrics and I've written music. She was just a friend, and she kept bugging me to write with her. And I think she's the very first person that I collaborated with, actually. And she just kept pestering me, and finally, just to shut her up, I did one, and it turned out really well, because she's a miraculous lyricist. I mean, she's really good. And actually, she's had quite a bit of success now, writing in the pop world. She lives in LA, and here she is, a middle-aged Jewish woman, writing with mostly with black, you know, writers, men in their like 20s. So it's a weird juxtaposition, but she's coming out with a lot of pop hits and things like that. And I love the stuff that we've done together. Very few people have heard it, but there's some really, really great songs.
On my bedside table is a note from Stephen Sondheim and a pair of wire glasses and the lyric to a new song, which I'll never play for you because it's far too sentimental and I don't want you to think I care enough to write a mushy love song now that you and I are really through. Oh, by the way, two bills are also there. One for the cable, which has really kept me sane throughout our breakup. Damn, I swore I wouldn't dwell upon our breakup. Well, the other is my Visa bill, a little heavier with all the junk I bought to kill the pain, to fill the space until I face the fact that you and I are definitely through. There's my talking clock now set to get me off to work, the new job you don't know I got. It's not impressive, it won't make you think I'm doing well without you, actually. I'm not so hot, I can barely hack it. And there are those earplugs I still wear to help sleep tightly through the nightly New York racket. Did you find one recently? Did it make you think of me and cry so hard you couldn't see? I hope so. Oh, but it really shouldn't matter. I also fondly hope you're growing fatter. There's a lamp that never makes me think of you. We didn't shop for it together, and you never put the lampshade on your head. It's by the bed so I can see, to fill my journal with the 3 gazillion reasons why we're better off apart. Or rather, why I'm better off without you. You, of course, have lost the greatest catch you'll ever have, and you will realize how much you care and languish in complete despair until your dying day, which won't be soon because you're so damn healthy with your veggie diet and your yoga, which I tried that time I had that awful cold. It nearly killed me, but I did it too. Impress you, since I never did believe that you could love me just for me. On my bedside table, there are 3 stones which I'm told have healing energy. They say you have to touch them all the time or they'll disintegrate. I feel like I'll disintegrate if someone doesn't touch me soon. But there were years before I met you, and I have my notes from Sondheim, and my cable, and my Visa, and my talking clock, and earplugs, and my healing stones, and journal to unwind me and remind me that I always have myself, and that I always have the lyric to a new song, and a lamp that never makes me think of you, 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 you.
From the It's Only Life recording, obviously another autobiographical song called On My Bedside Table, as done by cast member John S. Mankus.
Yes, utterly autobiographical. And it came at the end of yet another failed relationship. Oh my. But yeah, you know, it's interesting because different emotions, of course, were coursing through me as this relationship ended. A lot of wallowing, a lot of sadness, a lot of, you know, poignant memories. And I had written a really beautiful, poignant, sad, tragic song about the end of the relationship. And that lyric was, in fact, on my bedside table, as was a note from Sondheim and my glasses and all the things that are mentioned in the song. And I was lying in bed, and all of a sudden I just got really pissed and really angry about the end of the relationship and at the person, you know, at the guy that was on the other end of the relationship. And so, on my bedside table is an expression of that frustration and anger, which is, I think, healthy.
I get the impression there's a sign on the Holland Tunnel that says, if you go to New York, don't date John Aquino, because if you break up, he'll write a song about you.
Well, yeah. Well, but you know, if you don't break up, I'll write lots of songs about you. I hope that that's not the case. Although, given my romantic life, that might be true. I'm not sure. You know, I just have been focusing on career for the last however many years, and have been flying solo. But I think I'm getting ready for another one. I think I'm ready for another one. So if you know anybody, let me know.
Up next is the only male version I know of for John's song, The Song with the Violins. The name of the act is $3 Bill, of course, as in Queer is a $3 Bill. And they are vocals by Greg Anderson and piano by Nate Bussieri. Their 2006 CD is called The Heart of a Good Song, and the album specializes in the work of gay composers. Here's $3 Bill and Song with the Violins.
I play the same record again and again, hoping you'll walk into the song with the violins. I trust you've memorized your script. I've got my part down perfectly, but it's so hard to concentrate on my lines. I can't hear myself think over the song with the violins. It's getting late. Have you missed the turnoff or lost my number? I know your new number by heart. Your motorcycle worries me. One slip and you'll miss the suntan I got for you, the house I cleaned for you, the shirt I pressed, the tight new jeans, and the song with the violins. Impatience is tapping my foot, shaking my head, making me reach for the phone. Disappointment is tearing my eyes, shaking my words, taking me back to the first time you hurt me. And oh, we play the same record again and again, falling in step to the song with the violins. I've choreographed this lovely dance, and you with your two left feet stepping all over the Fred and Ginger possibilities, bumping the needle, leaving a gaping, hissing scratch in my favorite song, the song with the violin.
Okay, I know you've been wondering when we would get to the Broadway show, A Catered Affair. That would be now.
Around 2004, another pivotal person entered your life, Harvey Fierstein.
Yes! That wonderful fellow. Yeah, he heard the Grateful CD and wrote me a fan letter. We have mutual friends, and so he got my address and wrote me a fan letter. And I thought, well, that's, you know, wonderful, and I put it away in my box of letters that I keep. And then about a month or two later, he wrote me another fan letter saying, I can't stop listening to this CD. I've got it. I'm addicted to it. And my God, you know, and saying all kinds of nice things. So I got his number from our mutual friend and called him up and said, well, like, you want to have dinner? and he said, yes. In fact, there's something I want to talk to you about. So we had dinner, and he said, you know, he told me about A Catered Affair. It had originally been a Patty Chayefsky teleplay from the 50s and then became a Betty Davis movie with
Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah, with Ernest Borgnine and Debbie Reynolds, and a screenplay by Gore Vidal. And Harvey had fallen in love with it and wanted to turn it into a musical, and asked if I would be interested in writing the music and lyrics. And I said no. And, cause it scared the crap out of me. You know, the prospect of writing with this big famous person, and I really wasn't that comfortable writing for theater. I'd never written a full-length musical, only, you know, Urban Myths, which was short pieces sort of strung together. And it just scared me. It was really intimidating, and I just didn't want to go there. But he persisted, and eventually, after a dinner with Stephen Schwartz, the other thing was I didn't know if it was a good idea for a musical, and I didn't want to spend years of my life working on something that was going to not go anywhere. So I wanted Stephen to hear about it to see if he thought it was a good idea, and he, in fact, thought it was a really good idea and said, I think you should do it. I still wasn't convinced, so I went over to Harvey's house, because Stephen and Harvey both live in the same town in Connecticut, and I went over to Harvey's house and was sitting on his fabulous couch in his fabulous living room overlooking his fabulous swimming pool and the rolling hills of Connecticut without another house in sight, just, you know, and still I was waffling about doing it, and he said, listen, Cookie, Lacage bought me this house. What are you going to retire on? And I said, I'll do it. And so we did.
In the liner notes, it says, book by Harvey, music and lyrics by you. How did that meld together?
Very smoothly. Surprisingly smoothly. It was such a pleasant surprise that, you know, that the whole thing came together as easily as it did. Harvey wrote the book as a play. He wrote it as a play. Rather than leaving gaps and saying, put a song here, put a song, he just wrote it straight through as a play. And then sent me a copy and said, look, you read it, I'm going to look through it, let's each make a list of where we think there should be songs. And then we'll get together and have dinner and talk about our lists. And so I did, and we got together, and our lists were virtually identical, which is a really good sign, of course. It meant we were on the same page as far as where we thought song moments should be. And he can be a little fussy, and he's such a creative spirit that I think when he's not busy and involved in something, I think that he could have, you know, been calling me and how are you doing? What's going on? You know, I mean, and sort of nudged me a little bit. But actually, right after that, he wrote the book for the show between Hairspray and Fiddler on the Roof. So he wrote it. We talked about where songs should go. Then he was completely absorbed in doing Fiddler, which was perfect because it gave me the time, the uninterrupted time, to just fit songs into the places where we thought there would be songs. So what I did was just sort of take out a chunk of his prose and take that out of the sort of dramatic arc and replace it with a song that hopefully achieved the same thing. So it was really just a series of assignments, and it was pretty easy, actually.
My favorite song from it is Don't Ever Stop Saying I Love You.
Yeah, that one Harvey actually gave me the title for. And that's all. But I mean, he said, you know, I think there needs to be a love song here, and I think that the young couple doesn't want them to be like her parents, who never tell each other they love each other. And so he said, maybe it can be a song called Don't Ever Stop Saying I Love You. And that was all I needed, you know. And, you know, there in a musical, you want the sort of standalone, you know, love song, love ballad. And, yeah, I'm really proud of it. It reminds me, it's sort of very, sort of American classic popular song, like, you know, like Irving Berlin or one of those guys. It feels like that in a way to me, like it's sort of classic.
So that's the song that'll have a life beyond the show.
Well, one can only hope.
And rather than play for you the song from the soundtrack, I've got something special to share with you. The song was originally a duet, but John sent me a demo of the song restructured as a solo. In that format, it'll lend itself more easily for solo performers. Here's Milena Govich and Don't Ever Stop Saying I Love You.
I've never heard them say the way they feel, so I guess they must feel less. They never use those words make love real. They won't go near the words as though they fear the words. But me, I must confess, I need to hear the words. Often to soften this doubtfulness. Please tell me, tickling my ear, for as long as it's sincere, don't ever stop saying I love you. Please give me every single day that three-syllable bouquet. Don't ever stop saying I love you. Actions speak louder, sure. Love can endure without being told. But I need reminding, yes, a verbal caress to keep out the cold.
Did the musical live up to your expectations?
God, that's tricky. Again, collaboration, you know, and not the collaboration with Harvey, because as I said, that was really pretty effortless and joyful. But then, you know, a lot of people come piling in, and Harvey warned me about that. He said, you know, this isn't going to be ours once we have producers, once we have a director, and actors, and everybody is going to be messing with it. And that was hard for me, you know. But what we ended up with, I think, is a beautiful piece of art, and I am very, very proud of that. I think that it was publicized at the start a little bit wrong, in that I think that people were expecting to see Harvey, be bigger than life, comic, genius, wonderful Harvey, in this show about marriage. And I think they were thinking, you know, Father of the Bride or something, you know. And it's not. It's really much more like a...
It's not his story.
It's not... first of all, it's not his story.
Maybe,
and second
of
all...
not that character's story.
He's not... Right. And also, he's not being as much of a character as he usually is. He's, you know, toned down. And also, it's kind of like an Arthur Miller play with... You know, it's like Death of a Salesman. Somebody just said, a friend of mine said, it's sort of like Death of a Salesman with songs. And it kind of is. It's pretty intense. I mean, of course, there's humor in it, but it's also, it's, you know, it's a family drama. And the songs, there are no dance numbers. We did not have a choreographer. So it's a very different, I think it's, you know, what, in fact, Rodgers and Hammerstein and those people did take into an even greater degree. Take it, you know, what they did in terms of integrating the drama and the music, where people, some other people said that, you know, I didn't even notice that she was singing. She was talking, and all of a sudden she was singing, but it was just so seamless that it just seemed, you know, and that's a very different thing for theater. And the people who got that really loved it. And many, many people in the artistic community, the actors, the other directors, absolutely adored the show and thought it was the best thing they'd seen in years, and, you know, remarkable and groundbreaking and all those wonderful words. And some of the press felt the same way, and other, you know, press people didn't get it at all, and, you know, sort of criticized it for not being what they wanted it to be, which was, you know, having dance numbers and being a more traditional Broadway show. So, but I think it was very powerful. What I want all of my work to do is to be emotionally affecting. And the fact that, that people were not able to leave the theater because they were sitting in their seats sobbing, I think is a really good sign. So it made me very proud.
Coming up is a QMH exclusive, and I thank John for sending it to me.
Tell me about the demo you sent me for 79th Street Station.
Oh, you like that little song?
Uh-huh.
I do remember. This is actually kind of a good story. I was in Denmark with Holly, and it was wintertime. Maybe not the best time to go to Denmark, but it was beautiful. But boy, oh boy, was it cold. And we were staying at the home of some friends, and I was under a really cozy comforter. They have like the best down comforters in Denmark that you can imagine. And I had a dream. I had a dream about Joni Mitchell, who is one of my favorite songwriters. And in the dream, I was coming out of the friend with whom I most stayed before I moved to New York, and this was before I moved to New York. The friend that I stayed with in New York lived on 79th Street. And so I had this dream that Joni Mitchell and I were walking out of the 79th Street subway station together, and she was asking me why I hadn't written any songs in a while, and we were just, you know, chatting. And so that was the dream. And then I had that kind of gnawing feeling sort of scratching on the inside of my head, telling me to wake up and write a song. And I didn't want to wake up because I was so cozy under that comforter that I didn't want to get up and find a pencil and a pad and be in the cold of the room. I wanted to be under that comforter. And so that's where the chorus comes from. Do I want to open my eyes? You know, what do you give me if I open my eyes? It's like if I open my eyes and write a song. Muse, which I was casting Joni as, are you going to give me something good? Is it really going to be worth getting out of this comfortable bed to write, you know, write it down? So it's a kind of strange, poetic, convoluted combination of a dream and reluctance to enter into the writing process.
You came to me like the muse in a dream. You said it so hard sometimes, I said, I know what you mean. We were coming out of the 79th Street Station, coming out of the mouth of some personal hell. Together, but only in this dream. Do I want to open my eyes? Do I really? Is it worth it to open my eyes? What'll you give me if I open my eyes? You ask me why I haven't written you lately. I said, no need subway stop or what they did to make me feel this way. Sometime I'll take the steps two by two, no gum on my shoes, into a bright spring afternoon, and you'll get more letters from me. Do I want to open my eyes? Do I really want to open my eyes? Is it worth it to open my eyes? What'll you give me if I open my eyes? You laughed and shook your golden hair, and the sun flew off it like raindrops, soaking my eyes with the sight of you there, laughing and golden. It touched my hand as the light changed and walked uptown while I walked down. Then slowly, slowly I came awake, enough to think, should I write this down or catch another hour's sleep? Do I want to open my eyes? Do I really want to open my eyes? Is it worth it to open my eyes? What'll you give me if I open my eyes? Do I want to open my eyes? Do I really want to open my eyes? Is it worth it to open my eyes? What will you give me if I open my eyes?
Of what song that you've written are you the most proud?
Oh, golly gee whiz. I like the ones that don't feel like they've come from me, you know, that feel bigger than me. So, well, as I said, Unexpressed is my very favorite. So I'm really proud of that, because the music just makes me happy. Of course, I'm proud of Grateful, because I love what it says. And what, you know, the energy that it puts into the world at a time when I think we need any kind of positive energy we can get. And I get a lot of emails from people saying that song really touched their hearts. Other than that, I don't know that there's individual songs as much as just the overall body of work and the diversity.
I asked a long time ago, I asked Sway to pick her favorite song that she's recorded, and she kind of got this horrified look and choose among my babies.
I know. Well, that's what I said before. Which child? Pick a favorite child. I know it's an overused image by writers, but it's really true, you know.
And she's recorded several of your songs.
She has, and beautifully. She's fantastic. My gosh. We've talked about even working together. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but I would love to. I'd love to play with her. I think that'd be great fun.
I turned my head to look back at us, and I fell into a puddle of love, deeper than it had a right to be, as deep as anybody's ever loved for me. Fell into a puddle of love. Look at my face, look at your face, right in that oily rainbow, shining in a puddle of love. I lay there up to my heart in it, and wondered if we'd meet some ocean blue, deeper than we're ever meant to swim, so we can say we've never been all the way in. What's wrong with a puddle of love? Look at my face, look at your face, right in that oily rainbow, shining in a puddle of love. It's all compared to weight and size. You probably realize emotions can be light as a piece of a styrofoam cup. Even the
the shallowest water can hold that up. Oh, solid and sharp as broken glass, sinking down into the slime, honey. In deeper water, the sinking only takes more time. Zabado deep, bold and sad, and soot and see them bombs. We better do better, better do the abado, and double did the abado, and zeba do bo dam pam. I got up claiming to clean my clothes, blow my nose and point my toes to dry land. Internal rhyming gets better there. You stand a fair chance against despair on dry land. Now, Mongolia, Mojave, Sahara can save you from a burial at sea. But just when I think I'm dry as glue, I get a litchy for a splash or two. In maybe a puddle of love, look at my face, look at your face, right in that oily rainbow, shining in the puddle of love, nothing but a puddle of love, look at my face, look at your face, right in that oily rainbow, shining up, shining.
That's Puddle of Love, another track by Suede from her album Barely Blue.
How much of your writing is art and how much is craft?
I think the craft, I think it's kind of a Zen thing. There was a book called Zen and the Art of Archery that I really loved. And it talked about, in Zen, you master the craft to the point where, you know, inspiration can come through you and you've got the craft down. And so the art can happen. And I think because I've done it for so long, and I think the craft is kind of taken care of. I mean, there's always more to learn. My God, of course. But I think there's a certain level of craft that I've achieved that enables the art to happen through me because I have the tools to get it documented. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is there an overall message to your work?
I don't think there's an overall message, but somebody once said that I seem to be a little obsessed with time and the shortness of time. And I hadn't noticed that, but when she mentioned it, I think that may be true. You know, I think that the work expresses whatever I happen to be going through in my life, and I think I'm on a spiritual journey. I mean, I am on a spiritual journey, and I'm trying to absorb things and learn about how to grow as a human being, how to grow as a spirit, how to grow and evolve in every way. And I think that progression, that journey, that learning curve of mine plays out in to one extent or other in every song that I write. So I don't think there's one theme, but I think that, you know, who I am certainly pours into everything that I do. And there is a spiritual perspective, which I'm proud of. I think that is resonant for people, especially nowadays, who are looking for some rhyme or reason and some progression toward greater spirituality in their own lives.
Your answer ties directly into a quote I wanted to read by, it was a review by Stephen Holden in the New York Times. He wrote that the Mr. Bacchino's flowing, finely made piano ballads describe an urban single life in which relationships come and go in cycles of yearning, fulfillment, heartbreak, and healing. And romantic love is a serious quest undertaken as a race against time.
He kind of nailed it, didn't he, that Stephen Holden?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that sounds good. Okay. I'll buy that. Yeah. Sounds good.
And I love the possibilities of the lyrics of the first verse of this next song. They go, "Last night I played a song for you amid the social whirl. I sat there to the left of you and to the right your girl." So, this could be straight, gay, or bi, depending on who's singing it and the dynamics. Here's Chris Williamson's version from the 2003 album she released with Holly Near, called Chris and Holly. The song is called "I've Learned to Let Things Go."
Last night I played a song for you amid the social whirl. I sat there to the left of you and to the right your girl. My hands relayed the rhythm, my lips put on a show. Your presence brought the sudden thought, I've learned to let things go. A letter on the table holds a lifetime's worth of rage. Yet even as I sign, I know I'll never send this page. By years we're worn to tolerance, through tears we're forced to grow. With halting pace I reached this place, I've learned to let things go. Some danger though in letting go too early, as much or more in letting go too late. But those like me who cannot see the difference have to wait. I could only wait. Ripe with yearnings which dangle unfulfilled, we'll call for pointless sleeping until the feet are stilled. The smoke of dreams beyond my grasp conceal this calm tableau. I can believe it's for the best, I've learned to let things go. Yes, in my wisdom or defeat, I've learned to let things go.
I'm not sure you're going to know the answer to this question.
All right.
Excluding the musical, It's Only Life, what artist has recorded the most of your songs?
No, but I bet you're going to know it, aren't you?
What
artist has recorded? Well, Suede has recorded quite a few.
Only four.
Oh, so someone has recorded more than that. Wow. I give up who?
Bill Wright.
Oh, of course. Well, I worked on that CD. I should have known that. Oh, see, that was a trick question.
No, it wasn't.
Oh, I know.
And John played piano for the late Bill Wright on his 1995 album, Always Love. On his two albums, Bill recorded 7 songs written by John, including this one called Something Spontaneous.
want to smother you, don't want to be too cold, don't want to get lost in the ideal vision of love we've all been sold. Don't want to write a thesis here, but I do tend to analyze. We do tend to think too much, and something spontaneous dies. There's a tightrope between us and quicksand below. It's hard to stay cool on a tightrope when you know that you know that I know. We're putting our best foot forward. Every shake at your end of the line turns me into a jerky clown, ignoring the voices that are trying to talk me down. Don't wanna lose my heart, don't wanna get it wrong, don't wanna break the flow and grow apart before too long. Can't take it so seriously, mustn't over-organize. Shoot down a possibility, and something spontaneous dies. There's a ballroom between us. We forget there's more than one dance. It's hard to relax and let go when you're sure if you blow it, you've blown your big chance. We move toward each other like we're balancing books on our heads, enormous psychology books. Why don't we take a look at the comics instead? Don't want to be a dead horse, don't want to give up too soon, don't want to read a romance novel with the shade pulled down and miss the moon. Don't want to be critical here, but you're just about as bad as I. Pull up a chair, we'll have a talk about how we talk about how we talk too much and still lose touch and still get tempted to disguise how we tend to think too much and something spontaneous dies.
This brings us to the end of my special salute to the work of John Bacchino. Again, I thank him for the interview and you for sticking with me this long. Where most people would just do an hour show and be done with it, well, I just can't resist trying to really do justice to the artists I cover. I feel this is history I'm capturing. And in this case, I ended up with 3 hours of his wonderful music and commentary. So I appreciate your patience in taking this journey with me. Okay, I wasn't going to repeat a song during this special, but I can't resist closing part three with John's greatest hit, Grateful. This time I'm taking it from the Grateful compilation, and it's ably done by Michael Feinstein.
I've got a roof over my head, I've got a warm place to sleep. Some nights I I've got a mind that can think. There may be times when I lose the light and let my spirit sink, but I can't stay depressed when I remember how I'm blessed. Grateful, grateful, truly grateful I am. Grateful, grateful, truly blessed and duly grateful. In a city of strangers, I've got a family of friends. No matter what rocks and brambles fill the way, I know that they will stay until the end. I feel a hand holding my hand. Not a hand you can see, but on the road to the promised land, this hand will shepherd me through delight and despair, holding tight and always there. Not that I don't want a lot, a hope for more or dream of more, but giving thanks for what I've got makes me so much happier than keeping score. In a world that can bring pain, I will still take each chance, for I believe that whatever the terrain, our feet can learn to dance. Whatever stone life may sling, we can moan or we can sing. Truly blessed and duly grateful.